Well, this morning, in our ongoing study of 1 Corinthians, the passage that we are considering is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We have moved out of chapter 6 and into chapter 7, a loaded passage, a loaded chapter of 1 Corinthians. In chapter 6, he warned us at the end that our bodies are not for immorality. And then we come into chapter 7, and he gives us the positive side of God's gift of sexuality. Let me read these verses for you, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 7, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. By this I say, by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. If you're visiting with us, I just remind you that we do not just pick our topics randomly. We are just going through the Bible, going through 1 Corinthians. Today's topic is not something that I would normally address from the pulpit. We're not used to this kind of discussion, but God knows how he made us, and he made us with desires, and he gave us marriage to fulfill those desires. That is what this passage is about. The text gives instruction. In chapter 6, you saw the abuse of that. You saw that they did things that were wrong with their bodies. And then you come into chapter 7, and he says, this is how God designed. The proper context of the use of sexual desire is in the context of the marriage relationship. And that is what he's talking about in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Notice that verse 20 at the end of chapter 6. For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. And now he moves into chapter 7. This is how you glorify God with your body. You may have never thought much about it, but modest teaching on sexual fulfillment is an important shepherding issue. And the reason I say that is because the Bible has 10 chapters on this topic. Song of Solomon, 8 chapters. Proverbs chapter 5, and then this section here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And so my challenge this morning is to figure out how to talk about it in appropriate language for all audiences, but it's also a subject that most Christians don't talk about much, but think about. And God is not ashamed of it, and we should not be. God is not a prude about it, and neither should we. The world's influence is not reliable on this subject. The world cannot be our guide on this issue. We are sexual creatures, and we need to start out by saying that God made sex. Not Satan or a man and a woman who just came up with some idea. And it may shock most of us to hear that, because we're used to its misuse. We're used to all of the evil associated with it, that we would just assume that somebody else had to come up with it, not God. But the reality is that God is the one who created it. He created the physical relationship between a husband and a wife. He made it, and he's not afraid to talk about it, no matter how uncomfortable it might make us in talking about it. At the end of chapter 6, he said, you glorify God in your body. I showed you that. And here is the one way that a husband and wife glorify God in their bodies. Like I said, the world's made it into a spectator sport, but marriage, things are different. And God encourages the physical relationship. That's what this opening verses are about. In Genesis chapter 1, if you want to turn there and hold your hand in 1 Corinthians 7, in Genesis chapter 1, there's just some foundational things I want to say about marriage that lead us into this discussion this morning, or this passage this morning. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, he says, "Then God said..." Verse 26 of Genesis 1, you always go back to the foundation when you have questions, when you run into problems on issues. You always go back to the beginning. You always go back to the foundational things. And this is our this is foundational wisdom of God. "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" Verse 27, "God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over it.'" So God gives them some instruction on the physical relationship in that verses, that how you're going to produce a child. And then he comes down to verse 31 and says, "God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Very good. That's God's commentary on what he has just done and what he has just instructed Adam and Eve in how to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth is part of that. So we conclude from that God created marriage for several reasons. Number one, he created it for his glory. He did everything he does is for his glory. He puts his glory on display in his creation. It underlies the reasoning for all that God does. Secondly, it provides men and women fulfilling lives of companionship. You see that in those verses in Genesis. He brings them together. God is a Trinitarian God, and to share in the companionship of even the Trinity, he makes that possible even in human relationship of marriage. Verse 18 of chapter 2 says, "It is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." Number three, marriage provides the basic building block of society, which is the family. It's society does not work when this foundational building block is not functioning. You tear down the family and all of the relationships in society will crumble. And we're seeing this. We're seeing this. Verse 24 of Genesis chapter 2 says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." A fourth reason that God created marriage is for sexual purity and sexual fulfillment. That's what the focus of our verses are this morning. You can find it in Song of Solomon. You can find it in Proverbs 5. But it's created by God to satisfy God-given desires in a safe, pure, God-honoring way. Fifthly, it's for children. Marriage is for children. So you know that marriage is not required, unfortunately, to produce children, but it does provide a stable environment to instruct and raise those children. And sixthly, finally, it provides a picture of Jesus' relationship to the church, submission of the church. The bride of Christ, the church, in submission to the bridegroom, Christ. Loving headship in the church, loving submission in the church. That's to be in marriage as well. And God said all of that is very good. All of that is very good. So we should never just say marriage alone is an escape valve for sexual desire. It's an important reason, but it's not the only reason. There are other reasons. In 7:1, back to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1, Paul says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." You've got to understand the problems that Paul is addressing in the church at Corinth to understand his reason for the things he says in chapter 7. It's a long chapter. It's got a lot of stuff in it about divorce and remarriage and singles and all kinds of issues. But you've got to understand the context in which he is saying these things to the church at Corinth. Some of these are issues that you and I don't face. I think the principles are going to be there for us to apply, but some of these issues we don't face today. Some people do, but we cannot say that necessarily this is our reasons for needing to hear this message. A couple weeks ago, I told you in chapter 6, he's talking to the licentious. He's talking to those who believe all things are lawful. He's talking to those who have a dualistic view of the human body and the spirit. The body is separate from the spirit. You can do whatever you want to with your body. That's just desire. That's just biological. The spirit, though, is not affected by what the body does. Therefore, you can do anything with your body. He took the whole end of chapter 6 to show them that it does matter what you do with the body. He took the whole end of chapter 6 to tell them that God does care about the body and how it is used. And that he ends it with, glorify God in your body. But the main point of chapter 7 is different. It's a different issue. It's not the licentious that are being addressed here. It's rather the ascetics who are being addressed here. A key word, a key phrase in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is the phrase that says, remain as you are. You're going to see that over and over again as you go through that chapter. I'll highlight some of that for you next week. But this was a response to the ascetics because to them, fleshly desires and bodily desires were evil. And they should be suppressed. And they should be abstained from. They rejected marriage and sex. Totally. Marriage was inferior to the ascetics. Only the weak would pursue marriage. You would be considered spiritually inferior if you got married. And they were telling singles, don't get married. Fathers, don't let your daughters get married. And to those who were married, they were saying, Paul says, to those who were married, they were not saying remain as you are. They were saying get a divorce. Get a divorce. Put yourself in a higher spiritual state of being single, of being celibate. And if you're not willing to get a divorce, then have a sexless marriage. And that's what's being talked about in verses 1 through 7. Abstain from sexual intimacy in marriage. Avoid physical relationships in marriage. And that may sound odd to us, but that was very common view in the early church. If you follow church history, you will see that the view that marriage was a sort of a second-rate, second-class level of spirituality, that it was a higher level of spirituality to not be married. Very common. Abstain from marriage. It was part of Greek culture and some corners because personal wholeness and religious power. As I told you, it really didn't work well. People can say they suppress something, but they find ways to satisfy it somewhere. But the point was, here's the arguments that the ascetics had. You remember what Jesus said? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22, verse 30, listen to this verse. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are they given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven. Did you hear that statement? They took that verse and said, look, there is no heaven, no marriage in heaven. Let's bring heaven down to earth. Let's bring heaven down to earth and let's be like the angels. Voluntary acceptance of celibacy puts you on a status with the angels. That's what he's saying. In the Corinthian church, they thought you could achieve that level by refusing physical relationship in marriage. Others would say, if you go to the Old Testament, prior to giving of the law, What I'm sharing with you are just some justifications the ascetics had for saying the things they did. They said prior to the giving of the law in the Old Testament, before Moses brought the Ten Commandments, he told people to bathe themselves, to wash themselves. He told them to abstain from marital relationships for 3 days. And so, see, this thing began to gain traction. This kind of thinking began to gain traction. It was more noble. It was a higher level of spirituality to abstain from sexual desire. And what was even made this worse was this thinking carried over into the early church fathers. And they taught ascetic doctrines. And they taught things like Chrysostom taught this statement, virginity, and this guy was a great guy, wrote a lot of great things, a great expositor of Scripture, but he made this statement, virginity stands far above marriage as the heavens are above the earth. Jerome, he considered married people to be polluted, the church father considered married people to be polluted if you engage in marital intimacy. See, this guy hung around a lot of women himself, by the way. He was accused of immorality by a lot of people. How can you hang around that many women all the time and not be immoral at some point? But the point is, he made a statement like this, don't touch even in marriage. That's an early church father. Augustine said this, good marriage is good only if you are weak. If you are weak, you must have some option. Just a very low view of marriage. And that is the attitude that Paul is addressing, this ascetic teaching in Corinth that was being promoted. And then you had Jewish culture. Jewish culture, they believed that singleness was a sin. They believed that single men were of no account, single women were of no account. They were relentless in forcing people to get married. People that didn't want to get married, they were forcing people to do that. And where Paul is going to say, it's okay to be single. He's going to argue that both states are fine. Both states are of value to God. He's going to say there are challenges and benefits to being single and there are challenges and benefits to being married. That's what 1 Corinthians 7 is going to say. But they would say, no, you must remain single and not marry. Jews would say, you must marry and not remain single. So that's the ascetic view. Condemning of singles and promoting sexless marriage. And hey, divorce your husband. Divorce your wife. Paul says the married are to remain as they are. Singles can stay or marry if they desire to. It's not a sin. That's what Paul is going to argue in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul's going to say, just pursue the normal physical relationship. That's what verses 1 through 7 are about. They're not sinful, contrary to what the ascetics are saying. Married couples are to enjoy the physical union of marriage. And that is what he's talking about. And that's the reason he brings this up in this section. Let me break this down for you and just look at these seven verses this morning. Verses 1 and 2. I would say a way to title this would be the protective purpose of sex. The protective purpose of sex. Verses 1 and 2. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. So he's coming to a new section of this epistle. This is interesting. In 1 Corinthians, you see a break here. Now he's going to start a series of answering some questions. We're told at the end of 1 Corinthians that Stephanus and some others had brought him a letter. And in that letter were some questions. And this is one of the questions. This is what the ascetics were teaching us. Are we supposed to do this? Is it right for a man not to touch a woman? That's the question. Concerning that issue, Paul says, I'm writing you about that issue that you wrote to me about. This is an ascetic-driven question. Is sex defiling? Is it inherently defiling? Should couples get a divorce? Should there be sexless marriages? Is that more noble? Is that more spiritual? That's the question they're asking Paul. And so Paul plunges in, and he says basically what the ascetics are saying. That's what you have there is a euphemism in verse 1. That's a euphemism. That is simply means not to. Is it good for a man not to touch a woman? It's basically their mantra. It's basically what they would go around saying, and it basically means, is it good for a man not to have any sexual contact with a woman? That's the question. That's what they were teaching. Paul, is that statement right? Is that statement right, Paul? Banning sex in marriage? Paul rejects that. Outside marriage, you remain pure. We saw that in chapter 6. But in marriage, God created a natural attraction between a man and a woman. Within marriage, it's to be fulfilling and enjoyed. It's got a protective nature, you see in verse 2, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife. Each woman is to have her own husband. Protect means to provide a safe, pure, and God-honoring place for these desires to be expressed. Here's how Christians glorify God in their bodies, in this safe and pure, God-honoring relationship, and not outside of that. Hebrews 13:4 says, marriage is to be held in honor among all. Why did he say that? Because the ascetic view is always there. It is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. Some thought it wasn't spiritual, so they would go join a convent or a monastery. And that's the higher state, and that was taught. That was taught by the Roman Catholic Church. Each man is to have his own wife, and each wife is to have her own husband, says at the end of that verse. And when a church falsely delays marriage for people who have marriage desires, immorality increases. It doesn't decrease. And that's what you see with the nuns, as I told you before, and the priest throughout the centuries. Forcing people who had marriage desires, not those who desired to be single, but those who had marriage desires. They didn't have the gift of singleness. They were forced not to marry. Immoralities increased, not decreased. You see children born to people and hidden all throughout history. So Paul's just acknowledging the reality here. Acknowledging the reality. He's just acknowledging the reality that immoralities happen as a result. So you say this even to young men who are single, who have the physical desires of marriage. Begin planning and preparing to get married one day. Those desires are just going to still be there. But begin preparing and planning to take a wife, to lead a wife, and to protect a wife, and to provide for a wife. Be willing to move into that relationship. Too many are delaying it unnecessarily in some cases, maybe afraid of the responsibilities, I don't know. But if those desires are there, the only context to express those desires are here. And I'm not saying marriage is based on hormones. I'm not trying to put that into the equation, but it's a reality. It's a reality. And so men, young men, single men need to be, if God has given you, if you have those marriage desires, you need to be moving in that direction and preparing for that. I'm not trying to develop a hormone argument here, but the point is, it's just a reality Paul's speaking to. Young women, same way. It doesn't justify you getting into a dodgy relationship with some guy just because of hormones, just because you're scared you won't get married or whatever. But if there's not a young man that can lead you, that's not preparing himself to lead and provide for you, if he's not going in that direction, stay out of that relationship and just deal with your hormones. Because I say this to single people, there is no relationship more lonely and less fulfilling sexually than a bad marriage. And sexual intimacy does not make a bad marriage good. It doesn't fix it. There are other things. And so I say it just both sides of the ditch here. Pursue marriage. It's one ditch to pursue marriage for hormonal reasons. It's the other side is the ascetic idea that I will just stay single because it's more spiritual. And I want to be more pleasing to God that way or whatever. But there is a protective purpose, and that's the reality that Paul's expressing to us in those verses, those first two verses. The word have, by the way, the word have in verse 2 really means to have in a sexual manner. It's not just about having a wife or having a husband. It's having someone in a sexual manner. And so the marriage relationship provides a protective purity, a place to enjoy those desires. And so the idea of a sexless marriage is just not biblical, not biblical at all. Notice the second thing in verses 3 and 4 that Paul mentions. Verses 3 and 4, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop there just for a moment. But notice the word duty. Duty, I think the ESV uses conjugal rights. Conjugal rights is really not a good way to interpret that. It really has more to do with an obligation or a debt that you have to your spouse. It's like was used for financial debt, borrowed money, you had to pay it back. In marriage, there's an ongoing debt in marriage. A husband owes his wife, the wife owes to her husband. It's not an optional thing. It's a duty. Not considered tedious, it's a delightful duty. It's a duty to give. It's Mark 10:45 is the principle of all the Christian life. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, to give. Jesus did not come into the world to get, he came to give. And that is the principle behind every area of the Christian life, and especially in marriage, and especially in this area of marriage. It is to give, not to get. It's a delightful duty. It's a rewarding duty. First part of verse 4, it would be no surprise to the reader of this, the first-time readers of this in the Corinthian church, the wife does not have authority over her own body. They would just go, yeah, that's right. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Yeah, that's right. But they would go unconscious with the second sentence or phrase. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body. Nobody thought like that. This mutuality, equality in this area would have been so foreign to their thinking. To say we serve as equal, that there's two-way respect in this, that was not heard of in Greek society, Jewish society, at all. Yeah, he is to lead his family, but here it says there's a two-way street. Most people just viewed the wife as a tool. You used her for what you needed and cast her aside. That was the common thinking. And very few people understand this today, that the reason that women in our society are not treated like the women in Islam, where they're treated as slaves, is because of Christianity. The reason that women in our society are not killed when their husbands die and burned on their graves with their husbands' bodies is because we're not Hindus. And female circumcision that's practiced in some places in Africa. Listen, the reason that women are viewed highly and should be viewed highly is because of Christianity. It's a teaching of Christianity. Women's feminists don't get that. Christianity exalts women. They're not tools. They're not property. They are created in the image of God, and they are equal in salvation. And yes, they have a different role in marriage, for sure. But it's there to be served and respected and loved by their husbands. Verse 5 says this, "Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." And then I would include verse 6 with this, "By this I say, by way of concession, not of command." I'd put that verse, verse 6, with verse 5. I would not put it with verse 7. Some people put it with verse 7. But I would say it goes with verse 5, because he's still talking to the married. Verse 7, he's going to be talking to the single. This is talking to the married. He's saying, do not deprive each other. Maybe a short period of time. Well, that's a concession. That's how he's saying it. Don't deprive each other, maybe for a short period of time, but that's a concession I'm willing to make. That's how he means that. See, the ascetic would say to his wife, or if he was married, he would say to his wife, "I must devote myself to higher spiritual things, and because of that, I will not be available to you physically." And see, God forbids that. It's supposed to be consistent and generous with the spouse. It's not to be minimized. That's why he says, stop depriving one another. That's what the ascetics were saying to do. Stop stealing from one another. Stop defrauding one another. And so Paul's saying that because marriage is a commitment to fulfill your spouse's desires as best as you are able. It's a form of theft when you don't do that. You're breaking a contract. You're defaulting on a payment, a duty, an obligation. And I say this because marriage is much more than sex, but we don't subtract it. That's the point Paul is making. It's much more than sex. And we understand there are times when there are accidents. There are times when there's illness. There's times when people are just lacking in desire at particular times and things like that. We understand those things. And ours is rarely the ascetic issue. I'm going to go serve Christ. I'm going to go pray. That's what the ascetics would do. I've got something more spiritual to do than spend this time with you. Most of our deprivation comes because we're too busy with work, too busy with hobbies, too busy with children, too busy with family, extended family, that we don't give attention to our spouse. It's the real issue in marriage problems is poor companionship. Usually this area is a barometer of the whole marriage. How this is going is a barometer. If this is not going well, it's an indication something deeper is going on in the marriage. And a lot of times it's poor companionship. I'm not being a very good friend to my wife. If you go and read Song of Solomon, which I'm not going to do this morning, you read it and read it literally because that's how it's intended to be read. But she uses language when speaking of her fiancé that he is her friend, her friend, her friend, her friend. And sometimes I think I just need to be a better friend to my wife. Because as I said before, the sexual relationship is not going to fix a bad marriage. It should fuel a good marriage, but it will not fix a bad marriage. It starts with friendship. It starts with addressing issues. It starts with addressing conflicts. It may start with just some of those things that you would do in a friendship. And maybe that's the real reason for some people why this is at the root of things in this area. Some people have an unbiblical view of sex. It is very hard for me even to stand up and talk this sermon this morning, if you know the honest truth. I've been dreading it all week. But the point is, some people have an unbiblical view of it. It's dirty or defiling for some people. Some people associate it with being molested as a child, and they can't get over the images of that, and they have a hard time with this. That's understandable. That's understandable. Or hormones are changing. It's all kinds of things like that that doesn't mean the whole physical relationship has to be sacrificed. It's not to be the first thing that's set aside. I think what Paul's been saying, it's a basement condition in marriage, is the physical intimacy. And aesthetics can come along and say all they want to say and try to throw it out, but it's basic. And like I said, it's in His design. God designed it. It's there to fuel the rest of the marriage. And notice what he says in verse 5, "And come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Men cannot use this as the excuse for having an affair, by the way. "Well, she would not respond to me, therefore I found somebody else." That's not what this is saying, though it is saying that when you deprive each other, there's a danger of Satan looking for ways to get into your marriage and do harm to your marriage. When you don't close the security gate, you leave it open, he finds a way in. Make sure you're closing the gate. That's what Paul's saying. So Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You cannot say, "I'm not going to be physical or intimate with my wife or my husband because I've got the children, or I've got career goals, or I've got other higher elevated spiritual goals." Satan wants you to do that. He wants you to leave the gate open. So Paul's saying, okay, devote yourself, but then quickly come back together. It's not a command. Verse 6, it's not a command. He's reluctantly giving that exception. That's what he says in verse 6. "By this I say, by way of concession, not of command." I recognize there are going to be times like that. 1 Peter 3:7, "Live with your wife in an understanding way." Most of us think the command of that verse is the understanding way part. No, that's how you live with your wife. The command is live with your wife. If you live apart from your wife, you're opening the gate for Satan to put a wedge in the marriage. That's what you're doing. The protective, weakened wall is Satan is looking for a way to saw at it and keep sawing at it so he can snap the marriage bond somehow. He's going to find that link and break it down. Don't let him, Paul says. Don't let him. And we understand, for health reasons, all kinds of things, yes, we understand. But there's other ways to communicate. There's other ways to communicate. And the governing principle is in marriage is fulfillment, physical fulfillment. Verse 6, "I'm not commanding that you have these seasons of prayer. I'm not commanding that you have these times of seasons of doing things, spiritual things." He says, "I'm not commanding that, but come back together quickly." I think that verse goes with verse 5 because I think he's still talking to married couples there. Because now in verse 7, he specifically talks to singles about being single. "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." This is just something, a little postlude that Paul inserts here. Paul, they're saying everybody should be single. And Paul says, I am. I'm fine with that, you know. You know, I think Paul, I don't know if Paul was married or not. If he was in the Sanhedrin, he probably was. If he was esteemed as a Jewish leader, he probably was. But Paul never says, greetings to you, Timothy, and your wife. He never says, greeting to you, Titus, and your wife. It's interesting. I never hear about any of them being married. Peter, yes. Other apostles, yes. There was pressure, like I said earlier, in Jewish culture to be married. But since Paul had no desire for that as a church planter, imagine coming home. Honey, how was your day at work? Oh, I was stoned and left for dead today. I mean, just his kind of work did not really make it too easy on a wife. He was in his 50s, probably at this time that he wrote this, and felt no need to pursue marriage. And so he's just had a dangerous life and did not feel that that was something he needed to do or wanted to do or could do. In Matthew 19:12, you don't have to turn there, but Jesus makes a statement. He said, there are some men who are made eunuchs, but there are some men who make themselves eunuchs. Meaning this, and they do it, why? For the kingdom of God. They do it because they want fewer distractions. And you can serve Christ more if you're single. And whoever can accept this, let him accept it, Jesus says. But if you have emotional desires for marriage and that's important to you, then something you need to, men, be preparing for and women trusting God for. But there are challenges and benefits to being married. There are challenges and benefits to being single. You're going to see that as we go through 1 Corinthians chapter 7. John Wesley, I'll close with this, but John Wesley was single. He's the founder of Methodism. He was an evangelist. You've heard his name. And it's interesting. He got married when he was 48 years old. He didn't want to get married, but he got married when he was 48 years old. He was forced by friends who just knew he needed a wife. This is a total violation. So he marries this woman, and he never lived with her. Well, if he did, it was very rarely. He was always away. He lived with her, but he lived like he was still single. This was horrible, horrible example. She was driven to insanity. She would stand outside where he was preaching and just yell. And I don't know that I blame her. He just lived like he was a single man. Totally violating. Live with your wife. That's the command. And you do that in an understanding way. He didn't mind being away. He had the gift of being celibate. It was great. So she just got bitter and bitter, and it destroyed her. He was happy in his singleness. So to force people to remain single or to force people to be married, God gives some one way and some another. Paul's going to say that. There's nothing wrong either way. No matter what the culture's saying, no matter what the philosophies of the day are saying, he says you can bring glory to God. So the conclusion of all this is that sexual fulfillment of marriage matters to God. It's important to God. And like I said, it's not a topic we normally talk about on a Sunday morning, but God knows how he made us, and he gave us those desires, and he's given us instruction in those desires. And he's given us marriage as a safe, protective place to fulfill those desires. And they're not to be fulfilled outside the marriage relationship. God, thank you for our time. Thank you, Father, for your word and your truth. God, we thank you that you are not afraid to speak on anything, that there is no issue that you would leave us to wonder about, because you know us and you understand us. And we thank you this day, God, for these truths. In Jesus' name, amen.